honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 96-year-old Chuck Houston of Fresno, California, prolific F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, and author of the book Flying with Iron Angels. There are so many hidden historical treasures in this book. A famous first lady makes an appearance. There are some other names you'll recognize. But most of all, a real picture of what aerial combat in the Pacific was like for those pioneering carrier pilots like Chuck in World War II. And that title, The Iron Angels, remember, this was a brand new squadron aboard a brand new carrier. Chuck is a plank owner on the Wasp, CV-18. And there's another historic claim he has that ties back into his artistic skills. I mentioned his sculpting prowess, but he isn't bad with a sketch pad either. And if you read far enough in his book, you'll see for yourself. They were trying to find a name and an insignia for your squadron. And people were throwing names around, and they talked about the Red Rippers. And you write that, "One night, I awoke out of a sound sleep in BOQ with a mental image of a little knight in armor with angel wings and a halo, standing on a cloud and holding a big machine gun on his shoulder. I jumped out of bed and made a pencil drawing of this idea, and under it, I printed the Iron Angel." And of course, that image is in your book and on the squadron insignia. Is that really how it happened? Just in a dream, or just woke up in the middle of the night, or what?
That's it. Just woke up and there it was in my mind.
Is that something that's happened to you frequently over the years with a piece of art or a concept that it comes to you that way?
Oh, yes, very often. Lots of those ideas shape up while I'm sleeping or halfway, and lots of different ways the ideas come to life.
Well, and a lot of people have ideas, but sometimes they're hesitant to share them with others. So you get this idea, and you draw it up, and you write the Iron Angel. But then you have to see if anybody thought it was a good idea. What was the reaction when you started to share that idea with folks?
Well, it was a mixed reaction. Some thought it was great, and some were just lukewarm, as usual with people. But enough of them liked it along with me that it kept growing and growing, and pretty soon it was a reality.
I've interviewed so many veterans, a lot of them will show me their squadron insignia, or, you know, whether it's a different branch of service, their unit insignia. A fair amount of the Army Air Corps squadron insignias had something to do with a well-known cartoon character, and there were even some that were drawn by Walt Disney himself. So I guess you were in pretty good company with your little illustration there, huh?
Yeah, I'd say that's very good company. That became our official squadron insignia on all of our flight suits. That was our official insignia. I was very proud of that insignia and everything that it stood for. It was the trademark of our outfit. You were angels by act of Congress, but it would take an act of God to make you act like angels. Yeah, that was a comment that was made.
Well, let's get into some of those times where it seemed as though you had an angel on your shoulder, including one even before you got aboard the Wasp. So you write here, you say, "For those who haven't had such an experience, I'll describe some of the feelings a pilot has when going through a major crash in an airplane. October 19th, 1943 was the day my good luck almost left me. I was returning from a gunnery flight and ran out of gasoline while flying in the traffic circle around the field. My engine sputtered once or twice and then just quit. I was only a few hundred feet above the treetops, so I had about 10 seconds to drop the seat as low as it would go, cinch up my seat belt and shoulder straps as tightly as I could get them while I was gliding silently down toward the trees. As I started hitting the treetops, it became a very rough, very noisy ride that seemed to go on forever. When everything finally got quiet, my eyes were closed, and I remember at first thinking I dreaded opening them because I knew I would see my body cut to pieces. But finally, I did open the eyelids, inspected my hands, arms, legs, no blood, all seemed to be in good condition with no parts missing. So I unbuckled, stood up in the cockpit, and looked around. Only a small part of my plane was sitting on the forest floor. All that remained was the engine and the cockpit directly behind it. The fuselage was cut cleanly off about 6 inches behind the bucket seat I'd been riding. The back half of my plane was several hundred feet back in the forest, wrapped around a large tree which had refused to be cut down as we had hit it going sideways. The two wings were cut off completely, leaving stumps of the wing roots on each side. I could see the two wings hanging from trees far behind me. We had gone between two large trees that just sheared off both wings. Okay, I'm reading that, and I'm picturing that, and that sounds just about impossible that anybody could survive that. How do you feel about it?
Well, actually, it really was nearly impossible. With a crash like that, usually you're just all crumpled up and ripped up. But I made it through all those trees.
So, of course, my mind goes to those split seconds, those moments. You've got no power. You can't go anywhere else. You're just trying to find some safe place to land. And you see all these trees, and you ride in there. You close your eyes. It sounds like you thought that was it for you.
Oh, yes. It didn't look like there was much chance. It looked like that was the end.
And where does your mind go in a moment like that?
I'm not sure it goes anywhere. Maybe it sort of goes blank.
What did that feel like when you realized, hey, I didn't lose any limbs, I'm still all here, and I'm actually conscious, and I'm all right?
Quite a good feeling to know that you have all the parts of your body in one piece.
And so I'm reading your description, and I'm shocked that you survived. But it sounds like all your friends were pretty shocked you survived, too.
They were all surprised when I walked into the building because they all were sure that I was dead. They called me something when I came walking in, the ghost or something.
It says all of them in the wardroom agreed that my new nickname would be the spirit. When I walked into the room, they had thought it must be my ghost.
That did fit. That was appropriate at the time. They thought I was a goner.
I guess I should ask you. I know that wasn't your only close call, but when you survive something that appears unsurvivable, how do you process that? Do you try to figure out why or how or who, or do you just move on and not think about it?
You mostly move on, but it does make an impression on you. You realize how precarious our lives are. It can be gone in an instant, any day, especially the life that we were living.
So the Marianas turkey shoot is a legendary situation in World War II in June of 1944, the Battle of the Philippine Sea. As you have accounts of a lot of the different pilots in your squadron, you also have the tale of your first aerial victory. Joe Doherty, my section leader, spotted a Zeke being chased by several F-6s, and Joe cut in and fired. The Zeke flamed in the cockpit, did a wing over, crashed into the ocean, and exploded. By now, we were all getting separated, and I saw a Zero several thousand feet below, close to the water, with a few Hellcats chasing him, but unable to shoot him down. The Japanese pilot was really giving them a flying lesson, doing a series of continuous rolls, getting down close to the water, where our Hellcats couldn't match the maneuverability of the Zeke. Rather than join in this procession, I dropped down from the left side above the Zero in a steep high side run from 8 o'clock. I began firing just as he rolled belly up, and my stream of bullets cut through the middle of the plane, through the cockpit and pilot, then set fire to his wing root. I pulled through, feeling like I almost touched him as I passed closely over him. Then looking down and back, I saw a huge splash of water where he went in. Can you picture that as I read what you wrote about it?
Oh, yeah. I still have the picture in my mind from when I saw it years ago. The adrenaline is flowing continuously during those moments.
How close do you think you were? Were you in danger of crashing into him?
Oh, yeah. Within a few feet, yeah. Very close. It's hard to put into words. It's just, it had a long period to build up. A year or so of preparation, looking forward to it, and here it was. Here was the victory. I'm not sure that there's a word that will cover it.
This Marianas turkey shoot got its nickname because the situation in the skies that day was pretty unique. What do you remember about that big picture that day and everything that was going on around you?
Well, I remember the sky full of planes, their planes and our planes. It was just a big swarm of activity, and you had to look in every direction at once as you chased down one that you wanted to shoot down.
And I'm guessing you'd never seen anything like that before?
No, the sort of thing that hardly anyone ever sees. We were ready for anything, every minute.
Well, you write in here about seeing smoking and burning planes everywhere and parachutes everywhere. By the end of that evening, you find out that the Iron Angels, just your fighter squadron, had shot down 11 and a half planes, and those were the first victories that your squadron had produced. And then you heard that that day more than 400 Japanese planes were shot down. I'm just imagining if you guys have never shot down any planes before, and then you have one day where you shoot down that many and they're dropping like flies everywhere, was that kind of hard to fathom or take in?
Well, it's an exciting thing. You've been looking forward and working toward it. Now it's all happening at once. It's exciting.
It seems like from reading your accounts that you and those other pilots in your squadron became pretty close.
Oh, yes. About as close as you can get. We were up against life and death every day. They were good buddies.
You write a lot about your roommate, Gene Streeter. How long had you known Gene Streeter?
Oh, for years. We went to school at Fresno State together and played football together, joined the Navy together, went through training together and through the squadron. He was a friend from way back. Just a great guy. Just full of laughs and smart, capable guy, a very good friend.
What kind of pilot was he?
An excellent pilot. All of our pilots were excellent.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read this whole thing. It's from October 26, 1944, and you label it Gene Streeter's bad dream. Streeter wasn't scheduled to fly until later that day, so I was surprised when I woke up about 0400 and saw him already up and sitting at our desk. I knew he should have been sound asleep like our other roommate, Jiggs Lears. When I asked Gene why he was up so early, he told me about his terrible dream. In it, his plane had been diving out of control and he couldn't pull out. The dream seemed so real that he had jumped down from the upper bunk, run down the passageway, all while still asleep, and finally woke up in the head, being observed by two sailors standing water guard. Gene told me that after he returned to our room, he was so upset by this dream that he couldn't get back to sleep. He was still sitting there, wide awake, when I got up from my flight. So in your writing here, you're kind of foreshadowing what's happening here, because you and Gruber make it back from this hairy mission, and you get back on the Wasp, and some of your pilots were playing poker in the front of the room, and Gene Streeter was sitting on the arm of a chair watching the card action. You write, "I called out to him, 'Hey, Gene, it's really rough out there.' I expected him to come back with one of his usual funny remarks, but all he did was nod very seriously without smiling. This was so unusually solemn for him. That was the last time I ever saw Gene Streeter." Your book is over 400 pages long. It's a very thick, heavy, thorough book. And I don't know if there's anywhere else in this book that I saw you quote a verse from the Bible. But as you get into Eugene Streeter's last flight, the first thing printed there is John 15:13, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." Is that what Gene Streeter did?
Yes, he went in there to help his friends and was killed.
So again, this book is not just your memories, but so many others. And this was written by Bill Finnegan Miller, Torpedo Squadron VT-14. He was an aviation radio man. And he wrote, "ACAC was everywhere. We dropped our bombs. As we pulled out, I saw Lieutenant Cole's aircraft plunge into the sea just behind the enemy ship. I saw the ship firing shell after shell at Lieutenant Cole's plane. They were all probably dead from the crash, but aboard that plane was my closest buddy, William T. Billy. Suddenly, beneath us, and heading straight for us, were three Jap fighters. The other planes were out of ammo, except for my turret gunner, E.J. Such, and me. We had no fighter coverage, and it looked like we were hung out to dry. We were mincemeat for those Zeros. I guess we all blessed ourselves. Then, from nowhere, as if by a miracle, this VF-14 F-6F Hellcat came tearing between us and the Zeros. He set himself in between them, pulling them away from us. He battled the lead plane and was ganged up on by the others. He got one Zero, but the others shot him down. I feel he knew he had to save us and sacrificed his own life so that we would get home. I soon found out that pilot was Lieutenant J.G. Eugene Jarvis Streeter, VF-14, from Fresno, California. In that one second, he was more than enough fighter coverage. His courage will always be remembered by the combat air crewmen who watched in awe as Eugene Jarvis Streeter gave his life for me and the others in those torpedo planes. You see, our lucky streak continues as we return to the Wasp. I wish our luck could have returned Lieutenant Cole and Lieutenant Eugene Jarvis Streeter with us to the USS Wasp. I was getting a little emotional reading that. I mean, I wish I had Gene Streeter here to ask him. If there's anyone qualified to speak for him, it's got to be you. You grew up with him, went to school with him, trained with him, and you performed the same job he did as an F-6F pilot. So what kind of guts or courage or selflessness did it take for him to do what he did?
Well, the ultimate in courage and determination, you can't do any more than that.
Gene Streeter was credited with 4 aerial victories in World War II, and he had actually been given the Silver Star 8 days prior. But his actions that day, his final day, were recognized with the Navy Cross. The only decoration higher than that is the Medal of Honor. And his Navy Cross citation reads, Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter suddenly found himself as the only protection for 8 torpedo bombers which were making a strike against large units of the Japanese fleet. When 3 hostile fighters came in from above, he pressed home an accurate, daring attack, which destroyed one of the planes, and courageously employed evasive maneuvers with the remaining fighters, vainly attempting to lose them. Although his plane was so severely damaged that he was forced to effect a water landing, he succeeded in diverting the enemy aircraft from the torpedo bombers until assistance arrived, thereby enabling our planes to carry out their highly important mission. The conduct of Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter throughout this action reflects great credit upon himself and was in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. And the final line of that Navy Cross citation really says it all. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Such a powerful story. And Chuck, your old college football teammate really did live up to that passage you quoted from John 15:13. But at the time, you didn't know that for sure. One report that day suggested he may have been able to get out of his plane and make it to land. You write about how you pilots expected him to come walking back in someday. How you even experienced a recurring dream of exactly that happening, and it felt real. And his mother, Florence, maintained a shrine to him in her home, hoping someday her son would return. Because you were his roommate, you had to gather up his things, and you actually had the chance to visit his mother back here in Fresno.
I think that was harder than anything else. Just shooting down planes in combat is easier in comparison. I had a very high opinion of Streeter. There was always the sadness of knowing that his life was ended and he never had a chance to go on and do the things that I did later.
What an honor to share a little bit of Chuck Houston's story with you today. Visit hometownheroesradio.com for photos, a short video, the link to his book, and even a bonus-length podcast of this episode. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.